Israeli forces gunned down another Palestinian in the West Bank. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks in the occupied territories this year. Also in the headlines, Russia's ambassador to the U.S. warns that Washington's continued weapons supplies to Ukraine increases the risk of a direct confrontation. Thanks for joining us. Iran vows effective response and a tit-for-tat action if the European Union takes hasty and unthinking measures over Tehran's approach to the recent riots in the country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also expressed discontent with some European official stances on recent developments in Iran. Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Italian counterpart Luigi Di Maio. That's a day after the bloc said that it was mulling restrictive measures against Tehran in the wake of recent riots and unrest. Riots erupted after a young woman died in the hospital after being taken by the police. The Islamic Republic says a thorough and fair investigation is underway to ascertain the exact cause of her death, which was used as a pretext for rioting and vandalism. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the British ambassador to lodge a protest against the UK government's stance on the recent events in the country. Days of unrest in Iran over the death of Mahsa Amini has started to draw condemnation from many Iranians. In Tehran, a counter-protest was staged to denounce the violence. Yusuf Jalali has more.
The response to more than 2 weeks of violent protests in Iran over the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed at a police station and later died at a hospital. Demonstrators denounced street violence, saying there are peaceful ways to protest.
Today, we gather to protect our religion and to voice our support for the Islamic Republic.
Islam tries to promote these three slogans, woman, chastity and honor. So we came here to condemn those who seek to change our Islamic ideals.
The chaos began in mid-September, with protesters calling on the police to explain Mahsa's death. Over the past days, students in universities and schools have also joined the protests. On Monday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, shared his sympathies over the death of Mahsa Amini, while condemning the unrest. The West, and on top of it the U.S., have made supportive comments on the protests in Iran, something people call tongue-in-cheek remarks, made to fuel the turmoil in the country.
I should tell those who take to the streets and vandalize public properties that they are serving the interests of the U.S. These days, the American officials have been trying to fuel the flame of violence to get to their vicious goals in our country.
22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was taken by the police over her non-compliance with the Islamic dress code. CCTV footage released by police showed that she passed out at the police station for what was later revealed to be a heart attack. 3 days later, she died in hospital.
People believe protesters are playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. They demand an immediate end to the chaos and violence. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The senior Russian diplomat has criticized the Canadian government for sanctioning Iran's English-language news network Press TV, calling it a sign of Western leaders' weakness. Russia's permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna says that the recent move by Canada points at the authoritarian trends in the West. According to Mikhail Olyanov, Western governments leave no space for different views to compete. Instead, they dictate and brainwash people into believing what they want them to believe. Earlier, Ottawa imposed sanctions on Press TV and 33 other Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. Canada and Iran have had no formal diplomatic relations since 2012. Author and journalist Arnold August believes Canada follows U.S. policies when it comes to Iran and many other countries.
The Canadian government, over the last few years, with regards to many countries, but specifically with regards to Iran, they simply use the U.S. State Department and White House talking points against Iran. So that is the pretext, that is so-called repression of women in Iran. Interesting, coming from a country, Canada, a colonial settler state that is now famous throughout the world for having committed and still commits genocide against the native peoples in our country. They are in a position, a moral position, to judge Iran with regards to the question of human rights. I mean, it is basically a regime change effort pushed forward by the United States and Canada, unfortunately, as a very close and faithful ally of the United States, is following through on it by adding these sanctions.
The dual Iranian-American citizen Bagher Namazi arrives in Oman following his release from detention in Iran. Namazi left Tehran earlier Wednesday after 6.5 years in custody. He is set to travel to Abu Dhabi to undergo a carotid surgery before he heads to the U.S. Iran's foreign ministry says the 85-year-old was released on humanitarian grounds. Oman has thanked the Islamic Republic for facilitating his release. Namazi, a former official with the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, was one of 4 Iranian-Americans, including his son, Siamak, detained in Iran in recent years or barred from leaving the country. He was convicted of collaborating with what Tehran said was a hostile government in 2016 and sentenced to 10 years in jail. A court in Belgium has reportedly lifted the ban on the extradition of Iranian diplomat Assadollah Assadi, who is held in a prison in the European country. The court's judgment now paves the way for exchanging Assadi with a Belgian national imprisoned in Iran. The exchange, if implemented, is part of a prisoner swap between Brussels and Tehran. Belgium had ratified a treaty allowing prisoner exchange with Iran. However, a Belgian court of appeal in July stopped the country from extraditing Assadi, who was arrested 4 years ago. Assadi was detained while serving in the Iranian embassy in Austria and was later transferred to Belgium on unproven allegations. He was handed a 20-year jail term on charges of plotting an attack against an anti-Iran terror group, the MKO. Iran says that Assadi is illegally held, which also violates his diplomatic immunity. There seems to be no end in sight to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Regime forces have killed one more Palestinian during a raid on the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 21-year-old Ala Zagal was shot in the head by Israeli troops. The ministry says that at least 2 others were also injured during the Israeli operation near the city of Nablus. Israel has intensified its deadly crackdown against Palestinians. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories this year so far. Our correspondent Ramallah Mona Kandil joined us earlier with details on the latest killing of a young Palestinian man by Israeli forces.
Well, Israeli forces stormed the town of Deir al-Hatab, East Nablus, and confrontations took place between Salman Omran, who was in his house with his wife and family members. Clashes continued for almost 2 or 3 hours. During these confrontations, as you have mentioned, a Palestinian man was shot dead, Ala Nasser Zagal, 21 years old, from Deir al-Hatab. A number of Palestinians had been wounded, including 2 journalists, a cameraman and a journalist working with the official Palestine television channel. Following these clashes, unfortunately, the Israeli forces succeeded to arrest this Palestinian fighter after killing one Palestinian and wounding at least 4 others, including 2 Palestinian journalists.
Russia is regrouping its forces and gearing up for a counterattack in response to new advances by the Ukrainian army. Russian officials in Kherson say that they are preparing to deliver a retaliatory blow. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that Kiev is making rapid gains in the south and has already retaken dozens of villages in the regions of Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk. Those are the very regions that Moscow declared it was annexing days ago after holding referendums there. Russia has pledged to use all of its power to protect the regions integrated into its territory. Ukraine and its Western allies have dismissed the referendums as illegal. President Joe Biden has said that the U.S. will never recognize Russia's annexation of Ukrainian territory. The United States has pledged a new military aid package to Ukraine, despite Moscow's repeated warnings. Washington says that it will continue to support Kiev for as long as it takes. In our news review program, we discuss the consequences of the U.S. arming of Ukraine with our guests.
The United States announces a new batch of military aid to Ukraine amid Russia's repeated warnings about the consequences of more weapons supply to Kiev. According to a statement by the White House, the new package is worth $625 million. It includes HIMARS rockets, artillery systems, ammunition, and armored vehicles. During a phone call with the Ukrainian president, U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged to impose severe costs on any individual or entity that backs Russia's offensive. He also said that Washington will continue to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Meanwhile, Russia's envoy to the U.S. has warned that Washington's weapons supply to Kiev increases the risk of a direct confrontation.
The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries.
Well, the Russian diplomat also said that Moscow perceives U.S. military assistance to Kiev as an immediate threat to its strategic interests. The latest package brings the total value of Washington's military aid to more than $17.5 billion. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have author and commentator John Stepling, who's joining us from Inderøy, Norway. And we also have journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, who's with us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Stepling. I want to get your perspective on the United States announcing yet again a new batch of military aid to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned about the consequences of more weapons supply to Kiev. Is there a threat that this can spill over into other regions and possibly making this conflict morph into something bigger?
Well, of course there's a danger of it. Look, the U.S. has fought against any peace initiative, any kind of brokering of compromise between Ukraine and Russia. They don't want peace. They want a protracted war. They'd like a protracted but somehow controlled conflict. Money that is being poured in terms of weaponry, cash, training. This has been going on a long time. The U.S. started training the Ukrainian military even before 2014. This is set against the backdrop of social crisis in the United States, across the EU. The introduction, the commentator talked about the rise in prices in the EU. Even in relatively affluent Norway, gas prices, food prices have skyrocketed. I mean, unprecedented costs that are finally, you know, even here, people are struggling to make ends meet. It's much worse in other places, obviously. In the United States, it's, you know, this is a country suffering unbelievable unemployment, homelessness, a general despair across every part of the country, but the U.S. government doesn't care about that. There's, you know, these are ideologues who are in power, the Straussian neocons. They have a plan. They have targeted Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. None of this is new, and I've never seen the unleashing of propaganda of this magnitude ever in my life. The Russophobic propaganda, the anti-Russian stuff, is almost comical if it weren't so sort of tragic, really. But you know, Russian chess players can't play in world tournaments, ice skaters can't compete. I mean, ridiculous things. And when you look at it, this entire conflict has been fomented by the United States, unnecessarily expanding NATO. To the previously, you know, described by mainstream press, Ukraine had been for the previous years described as most corrupt country in Europe, but suddenly it's the darling of the West. They put in a government in 2014 that was handpicked by Victoria Nuland, John McCain, and Russia has essentially been left with very little choice. And you know, the people in Donbass, of course, think Putin stopped a war. He didn't start one. That was a region being shelled for 6 or 7 years. Russia went to the UN in 2018 asking for peacekeepers. They have bent over backwards trying to solve this, you know, without compromising their security. But as I said at the beginning, the U.S. wants a conflict, and that hasn't changed. And they just keep escalating and doubling down on the mistakes they're making.
Fred, we're in Moscow. I want to get your thoughts on what Mr. Stepling just said, that the United States, in fact, wants a conflict. The U.S. President Joe Biden has said Washington will continue to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Is that what they're aiming for here, to make this a prolonged and protracted conflict in hopes of weakening Russia?
I do agree that the United States has embraced this conflict. I think there's a lot of blame to go around, and I don't absolve Putin of his share. I think it was a reckless move to invade Ukraine, but yes, there's a long, long story leading up to that decision. And after Russia did invade Ukraine, the United States and its allies clearly went all in to try to weaken Russia. I think they said as much, to try to restore or even enhance some kind of American leadership or hegemony, whatever you want to call it, by using this crisis to pressure other countries like India into joining the American effort against Russia, to demonize Russia, yes. And so that's all true, and I think that the constant flow of arms and aid into Ukraine is prolonging the war, deepening it. And since it's occurring completely in the absence of any diplomatic efforts on the part of the United States or any other leading Western power, you may assume that that's what they want.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. And journalist and political commentator Fred Weir speaking to us from the Russian capital, Moscow.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
With the reduction of gas delivery operations through Russia's Nord Stream pipeline to European countries, the fear of a gas shortage in the Green Continent has intensified. Most European countries and even other countries that are dependent on gas imports are confident that they will face a severe energy crisis this winter. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency tells us more. According to the International Energy Agency's gas market report for fourth quarter of 2022, published on Monday, 3rd of October, global natural gas markets are set to remain tight next year, with lower gas flow from Russia to Europe, high gas prices, lower demand, and the impact of energy-saving measures. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, said, as Russia's curtailment of natural gas flow to Europe leads to new highs of international prices, it also disrupts trade flow, leading to fuel shortages in some emerging and developing countries. According to the report, Russia's reduced flows to Europe deepens market tensions and uncertainty ahead of the coming winter, not just for Europe, but also for all markets that rely on the same supply pool of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. According to the report, the record high prices seen in European and Asian spot LNG markets reduce gas demand and incentivize the switch to other fuels such as coal and oil for power generation. Europe's gas consumption dropped by more than a record 10% during the January to August of this year, compared with the same period in 2021. Driven by a 15% fall in the industrial sector as factories curtailed production. Europe increased liquefied natural gas, LNG imports, as well as alternative pipeline supplies from Norway and elsewhere to offset the sharp falls in Russian gas supplies. Europe's demand for liquefied natural gas, LNG, grew by 65% in the January to August of 2022. Compared to a year earlier. This demand has drawn supply away from the traditional buyers in the Asia-Pacific region, where demand contracted by 7% over the same period due to higher prices, mild weather, and continued COVID-19 lockdowns in China. With the impact of market tightness and high prices, a 0.8% decline in global gas consumption is expected this year, with a record 10% contraction in Europe and unchanged demand in the Asia-Pacific region. Global gas consumption is expected to grow by only 0.4% in 2023. However, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, said in the report, the outlook is subject to a high level of uncertainty, particularly in terms of Russia's future actions and the economic impacts of sustained high energy prices. Britain's Financial Times newspaper explains more about the same story. Recently, the head of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Birol, said the scramble for energy resources between the European Union countries this winter could destroy European unity and trigger social unrest. As quoted by the newspaper, Fatih Birol said, "The implications will be very bad for energy, very bad for the economy, but extremely bad politically." According to the newspaper, Birol said the growing energy crisis in Europe raises concerns that some countries may conclude third-party deals for imports of gas from Russia or restrict the export of electricity to their neighbours. In this case, European countries will cease cooperation with each other and everyone will be on their own. Fatih Birol added, "If Europe fails this test in energy, it can go beyond energy implications." In addition, the International Energy Agency head cautioned against the European Union complacency after the European Union managed to accumulate natural gas reserves ahead of this coming winter. According to Birol, even if Europe avoids negative surprises in gas supplies, such as colder than expected winter, it will face other consequences in the coming months, including an economic downturn and significant damage to household budgets. The start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in February of this year exacerbated the energy crisis unfolding in Europe over the past year. Disruptions in logistical and financial operations due to the conflict and Western sanctions against Russia have undermined supply chains and led to a spike in energy prices worldwide. Moreover, the Reuters news agency has more on this story. The International Energy Agency's forecast that Europe's LNG imports will increase by over 60 billion cubic meters this year, or more than double the amount of global LNG export capacity additions, keep international LNG trade under strong pressure for the short to medium term. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, said in its latest gas market report published on Monday, 3rd of October, it said, "This implies that Asia's LNG imports will remain lower than last year for the rest of 2022. However, China's liquefied natural gas LNG imports could rise next year under a series of new contracts concluded since the beginning of 2021, while a colder than average winter would also result in additional demand from Northeast Asia, further adding to market tightness. The International Energy Agency's resilience analysis of the EU's gas market finds that the EU's gas storage will be less than 20% full in February of 2023, assuming a high level of LNG supply in the case of a complete Russian supply shutdown starting from 1st of November 2022. And without demand reductions in place or if Russian pipeline supply is completely cut. Storage levels drop to 5% of full capacity, assuming low LNG supply as storage falling to these levels would increase the risk of supply disruptions in the event of a late cold spell this winter. According to the analysis, a reduction of 9% from the average level of the past 5 years in EU gas demand through the winter months would be necessary to maintain gas storage levels above 25% in the case of lower LNG inflows. A reduction in demand of 13% from the 5-year average will be necessary through the winter period to sustain storage levels above 33% in the case of low LNG inflows. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, warned, "Therefore, gas-saving measures will be crucial to minimize storage withdrawals and keep inventories at adequate levels until the end of the heating season." The announcement of the emergency is likely to heighten fears of blackouts because the United Kingdom relies on gas-fired power plants for the largest share of its electricity supply.
first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Now we'll listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Osama al-Attar.
Al-Mutawakkil al-Abbasi, he summoned al-Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam from Medina to come to Samarra. With him came al-Imam al-Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam, his son. The city of Samarra, in that city of Askar, in that city of the military, the Imams went through so much struggle. He is in a city where he's surrounded by military, especially Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, because they knew he was the 11th Imam, the 11th in the chain, and after the 11th comes the 12th. They knew this. So constantly the Imam and his house was under surveillance. They would send maids to work for the Imam who are spies to see if any of his wives would become pregnant. So they would go and kill her. Many times they go and attack the Imam's house, alayhi salam. So this was the life that they lived through. One day the Imam, alayhi salam, tells his companions, he says, this time, at this period, when you see me going outside, don't give salam to me, don't point at me, don't even look at me, don't make eye contact, because they will kill you, you'll be persecuted. But even then, in these difficult times, you find if people seek the Imam, if people look for the Imam, if people really ask for the help of the Imam, for the guidance of the Imam still guide them, still help them. In this difficult time that the Imam instructed his followers not to make any eye contact, it is said one man came into a city. One of the companions of the Imam says, I saw the stranger walking in the city. I told him, where are you from? He said, I come from far away. He said, why did you come here? He said, listen, I am one of the children or the grandchildren of Abu Dharr al-Ghafari. I'm Ghafari as well. I heard so many conflicting reports about the imamah of this imam, Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, al-Hasan al-Askari. Conflicting reports. Some people say he's imam, some people say he's not imam. I've come here to investigate for myself. I want to investigate it. Is he an imam or is he not an imam? This companion of the imam says, as this man was talking to me, Imam al-Askari salamullahi alayhi passed by. When he passed by, he looked at this man, this foreigner. He said, A Ghafariyun ant? Are you a Ghafari? The man said, yes. Imam looked at him and he said, Kayfa fa'alat ummuka hamdaway? How is your mother hamdaway? He named his mother. How is she doing? The man then looked at him in surprise and said, she's okay, alhamdulillah, she's fine. And the Imam went. He then continued. This companion of the Imam looks at this Ghafari. He tells him, did you meet this Imam before? Have you met him before? He said, no, this is the first time. I've never met him. He's never met me. He said, so now are you satisfied with what you just saw? He says, even less than that would be even satisfying. This is even greater than what I had expected. So when people turn to Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, at these difficult times, no matter how difficult the time is, Ahlul Bayt turn to the Shia, turn to the Muwaleen, turn to their supporters. But you find Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and their supporters going through these difficulties as long as the goal is the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The pleasure of Allah. They're being harassed, they're being imprisoned. So many times Imam al-Askari, Imam al-Hasan salamullah alayh, gets put in prison. And sometime later they release him. And then they put him in the prison again. And then they release him. And so on and so forth. So many times. This is a mu'min. He is in constant struggle in dunya. He works hard in dunya. But as long as the goal is the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is the ultimate goal. And Imam al-Askari played such a big role. So he played a role, among the roles, the many he played, of course, is one, to prepare the Shia for the ghaiba of the Imam salamullah alayhi. Second, is to preach about the madhab of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And third, to protect the Shia. At the young age of 28 years old, he was given the poison by the Khalifa of his time, Al-Mu'tamid Al-Abbasi. And they were actively searching for the son, because he's the 11th, they know there should be a 12th. In fact, when they gave him the poison, they came and they stayed at his house, and the Khalifa pretended to be a nice person, so he brings some doctors so that they could look at the state of the Imam. But even these doctors were actually spies. Even the doctors were spies. Everyone was trying to see, do they find a boy? Is there a child somewhere here? Is there someone? Nothing. Nothing. Until finally they give up. They say, no, I don't think there is anybody in this house. Any children. So they leave the house. And maybe this is part of the rahmah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The mercy of Allah. And as they leave the house, then the pain becomes more difficult on the Imam salamullahi alayhi. Imam al-Askari, despite his greatness, the son of Imam al-Hadi, he has a brother by the name of Ja'far al-Kadhab, Ja'far the liar, son of Imam al-Hadi. He was not a good mu'min, unfortunately. Imam al-Askari leaves this dunya. Imam al-Mahdi, salamullahi alayhi, is with him. He takes care of the ghusl and the kafan. And then Ja'far al-Kadhab stands to pray on the Salat al-Mayyit, on his brother. Some of the Shia, they say, we know that only a Ma'soom can pray on the Ma'soom. So some of them started to have doubt. They started thinking, my gosh, is he the next Imam? Then deen is finished if he's the next Imam. They started to get worried, because they see him standing there and he's about to pray. All of the sudden, the faraj comes, subhanallah, the help comes. They see a young boy coming out, and he stands before his uncle, and he says, Ya Am, my uncle, you know that this is not your place to stand, it is mine. Now, the uncle had never even seen his nephew, he never even knew he existed. But subhanallah, haqq, when it comes with power. And batil is so weak, even though the man is much older, he's only a child physically, he's only 5 years old, but yet he comes with eloquence, with power, with truth, that the uncle just keeps silent, خلاص, cannot say a word, because he knows he's wrong, he knows he's not the one. And he steps aside, he says, step aside, my uncle, step aside. So he steps aside, and the Imam salamullahi alayhi leads the salat on his father. Salatul Mayyit. Then a group of people, or a servant that the Imam al-Askari sent with some money, and he told him, the one who will ask you about this money is indeed the Imam after me. Imam al-Mahdi salamullah alayhi turns to the servant and he tells him, where is the money that my father gave you? And it is this much, give it back to me. So this man feels very happy, and this is also part of the rahmah of Allah. So people do not have doubt that this is indeed the Imam. He does exist. He did pray on his father. He is there, but he is in ghaiba. And then the Imam salamullahi alayhi buries his father al-Askari next to Imam al-Hadi salamullahi alayhi in the same house. Imam salamullahi alayhi takes care of the burial, the ghusl and the kafa, the burial, and then he goes into ghaibatul sughra. And until today, after about 70 or so years, he goes into Ghaibatul Kubra until today.
Today is a day of celebration. We celebrate the start of the Imamate of Abu Saleh al-Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, the 12th infallible successor to the Holy Prophet of Islam and the promised savior of mankind. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this auspicious occasion.
In the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and is stealing their land since its inception. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Gaza on Screen: How Palestinian Truth Implicates All of Humanity. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Telling you the truth, the Israeli regime, military, or propaganda, from which major U.S. and European media outlets, including the BBC and New York Times, take their cues, or countless Palestinian filmmakers transforming the facts of their experiences into artistic truth. Where do sublime works of art stand vis-a-vis the relentless barrage of falsehoods and propaganda that conquerors habitually spin to justify and camouflage their barbarians? What is a Ghassan Kanafani novella, a Mona Hatoum artwork, a Mahmoud Darwish poem, or an Ilya Soleiman film next to Israeli regime tanks, fighter jets, smart bombs, assassination squads, nuclear submarines, or sharpshooters? When an empire is vast and variegated like the U.S., it can afford both military thuggery around the globe and ingenious filmmakers such as Stanley Kubrick, Oliver Stone, or the Hugh brothers to dismantle the lies of those conquests. When a settler colony like the fabricated regime of Israel is too small to afford such complexities, it just bombs, maims, and murders, while its propaganda machinery does the camouflaging in manipulated news coverage. In the Palestinian case, there is no military to speak of. What they have on their side are facts and truth, truth that would have gone unheard were it not for the Palestinian poets, journalists, scholars, artists, novelists, and filmmakers. But isn't this comparing apples and oranges? The military might of a settler colony to the works of art that those under its occupation produce? But that amounts to asymmetrical warfare. Palestinians have no military, air force, or navy. The Zionists do. Palestinians do not receive billions of dollars in military aid from the U.S. and Europe. The Zionists do. Palestinians wage only a form of guerrilla warfare imposed on them by cruel fate. Militarily, Palestine is no match for the fake regime of Israel, but artistically, aesthetically, morally, and imaginatively, the Zionist regime is no match for Palestine.
Take the most recent Zionist regime atrocities in Gaza earlier this month. A relentless blockade and repeated invasions of the Gaza Strip culminated in yet another war of aggression that terrorized Palestinians, destroyed their homes, and denied them their livelihoods. What is the function of Palestinian filmmakers in times of such Israeli terror? The dominant US and UK media consider themselves to be truly objective and fair when they pronounce that there are two sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as they claim. But there are not two sides of the Zionist regime's systematic, purposeful, and relentless occupation and theft of Palestine and the murder of Palestinians. There is only one truth, which has no sides. The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and stealing their land since its inception. A key element of this resistance has been cinema. With around 2 million inhabitants on some 365 square kilometers, Gaza is among the most densely populated places in the world. Many observers call it the largest open-air prison. The fabricated regime of Israel has systematically used the territory to test its most recent weaponry, causing death, destruction, and despair to Palestinian civilians. The choice of Gaza as the theme of a film festival was emblematic of the larger Palestinian question in light of their status as victims of European colonial conquest. In Gaza's Metaphor, a 2016 collection edited by Dina Matar and Helga Tauli-Suri, insightful essays describe how Gaza has become a metaphor for the larger Palestinian struggle. It is a floating signifier, open-air prison, terror, resistance, occupation, siege, trauma. But we should not be trapped inside such metaphors. Rather, we must see through them. Their simple truths reference the disposition of a nation and its landscape of history and humanity. Palestinian art and cinema receive, recast, and reassert that history and humanity. Gaza is not a metaphor for cruel world. Gaza is that world. The battle the Israelis have lost is not a battle between two narratives. It is a battle between truth and charlatanism. More specifically, it is between the aesthetic sublimation of Palestinian truth through visual and performing arts and the banal propaganda administered by the Zionist regime spin doctors. For example, after Israeli regime forces killed more than a dozen children in their latest operation, the Zionist propaganda initially alleged Islamic Jihad was to blame for most of its deaths. There is no aesthetic sublimation of the falsehoods of Zionism, for it is bereft of any truth to raise the aesthetic sublimation. It has lost the uneven battle between the Zionist regime lies and Palestinian truth. Palestinian and other journalists, Arabs and non-Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims, have worked tirelessly to expose these lies and report the bare facts. Gaza, the names and faces of the 17 Palestinian children killed in Israel's onslaught, reads one recent Middle East Eye headline. At least 49 Palestinians were killed and more than 360 wounded as Israeli airstrikes rained down on the besieged strip over 3 days. There is no corporate or mainstream monopoly over the news anymore. Pro-Israel outlets such as the BBC and New York Times are just a click away from countless other outlets that are doing what those institutions have failed to do. But the fact that journalists exposed never speak for themselves, they must yield to the imaginative power of the arts to find a universal tongue that the world understands best. Gaza on screen is no mere corrective lens for Zionist, European, and American propaganda. It is a perfect mirror of a heroic defiance of cruel fate. In the face of that mirror, we cannot be fatalistic, for we are witnessing a Palestinian truth that implicates the rest of humanity, and the Israelis in particular, should they ever dare to face that mirror.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. Infaq means spending in such a way as to fill a gap for a worthy cause. Where are those who spend millions, sometimes even for what appears to be a good cause, only for the Quran to say that they are the most ill-fated of people, because what they are doing is not called infaq in the Quranic sense of the term. Say, shall we inform you about the biggest losers in regard to works? Those whose endeavor goes awry in the life of the world, while they suppose they are doing good. They spend a fortune feeding some hungry people, and yet this is nothing but appearance and deception. This is not infaq. Why? Because it does not fill a gap. When you give 5 riyals to someone who has 500 riyals in his pocket and could add another 100 to this, this is not infaq. On the other hand, if you give this to someone who needs 5 riyals to buy a single loaf of bread to fill his stomach, This is infaq.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
However, I do not say this so that after the session, everyone here will go and give 5 riyals to the first hungry person they find to fill their stomach. This is because filling an empty stomach is not necessarily infaq either. In some conditions, this is the case. For example, when poverty and hunger are like countless weeds covering the ground, filling one stomach is like pulling out one weed. But what difference does one weed make? Okay, so you can see one weed has been uprooted. But how essential is this? How important is this? Therefore, infaq means to fill a gap, to satisfy a need. If some people today needed something like air and water, and you help them by giving them something else, this also would not be infaq. Equally, if you give them ill-gotten wealth, this would also not be infaq. Therefore, infaq is not something everyone does. Infaq is what clever people do. Clever people identify people's needs and are prepared to do what is necessary to fill the gap that gives rise to these. Spending in this sense is very important. One of the marks of taqwa is to spend in the good times and the bad. And suppress their anger. كاظمين الغيظ. They do not forget. They restrain their anger and displeasure. It is only when a person holds their anger in check that they can, with reason and understanding, do what is correct.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.